We're going to start the program today talking about Ramadan. That is the Islamic holy month, and it has now begun around the world. This is the time of year when observant Muslims abstain from food and water during daylight hours. It is a time meant for self-reflection and atonement. But at this moment, many of the headlines about Muslims around the world are about conflict and war, from Iraq and Syria to Kenya and Nigeria. And that might cause many to wonder, how is that possible during this holy period? So we've called two of our regular contributors who often comment on matters of significance in the Muslim world. Asra Nomani is back with us. She is a journalist who's worked in Pakistan. She's author of the book Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Asra, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks.
Also joining us is Arsalan Iftikhar. He is the founder of TheMuslimGuide.com. He's an adjunct professor at DePaul University and a regular contributor to our Barbershop Roundtable. He's joining us from Aspen Public Radio in Aspen, Colorado, where he's participating in the Aspen Ideas Festival. Arsalan, welcome back to you as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle. Anytime.
Asra, when you were reporting from the Middle East, did attitudes about change, about conflict, change during this holy period?
Well, there was this ordinary observance that happened. I was in Pakistan right after bombs had dropped in Afghanistan in 2001. And I was sitting in Karachi, and you could literally hear the fighter jets and the bombers go across the skies to Afghanistan. And what I noticed was that people would continue with their ordinary lives, but there would be this sadness also that was within their thinking and their conversations, because there was war and conflict all around them.
Arsalan, you wrote last year that, quote, leaders around the world, religious or otherwise, must leverage Ramadan to find peaceful political situations for these internal violent quagmires plaguing the Muslim world. Have you any evidence of that ever happening? Do you have any sense that that does influence the thinking of the people who are direct participants in these conflicts?
Well, Michelle, it should, because the Prophet Muhammad, who is the Prophet of Islam, had categorically forbidden any sort of fighting during the month of Ramadan and other months during the year. And, you know, as I called for last year in a Time magazine website article, you know, the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon had also called for a ceasefire, particularly in Syria at the time, because of the demolition of Homs, to allow for humanitarian aid for relief organizations to get in so that refugees could have access to the corridors to Turkey. I mean, it's not a time, you know, you're not going to end a war in a 30-day period, but if you have a 30-day cooling-off period in any armed conflict in the world, as an international human rights lawyer, you know, you can create temporary humanitarian corridors, you can get food and, you know, medical resources to people who actually need it. And, you know, I think it gives both sides on any side of a conflict the opportunity to think about really what's going on.
I wanted to ask you about this, because I know neither of you is a Islamic scholar per se, but you've done a lot of study into the history, you know, of the faith as well. Is it your sense that the part of the purpose of Ramadan, in addition to kind of the spiritual purpose, is to provide that kind of cooling off period? But the question is, do we have any historical sense of whether that actually occurred?
You know, when I think about this month, I always think about how it is that the concept with which we're born in Islam, the idea is that the breath of God enters into you in your mother's womb, and it's nafs al-ruh is the concept. And and what we're talking about right here is a jihad of bodies, right, of war, of people who are at conflict with each other. But really, the deeper purpose in Ramadan is to have a jihad bil nafs, a struggle of the soul. And that's what I think is this moment and this opportunity. Historically, there's always been this call for ceasefires, and there's this calming that happens within Muslim communities. And that's what I think we're in that moment of struggle. Right now, this, you know, new force through Iraq has asked all Muslims to claim allegiance to it. I, as a Muslim, would never claim allegiance to this new organization. And this is a struggle within our community for our soul and what direction we're going to go. And as Arsalan is saying, you know, we have to take this pause and really try to reflect on what we can do to bring healing to our communities.
Arsalan, what about that?
Yeah, you know, it's a very good question, Michelle. There's a very famous saying of the Prophet Muhammad where he says that whoever does not give up evil actions during the month of Ramadan, then God is not in need of them to give up food or drink during the month of Ramadan. You know, Ramadan is not just a, you know, a fasting exercise where you're abstaining from food and water for 30 days from dawn until dusk. It is a spiritual cleansing exercise, and it is as much internal as it is external. And as the Prophet Muhammad said in the saying that, you know, anyone who doesn't give up evil actions during Ramadan, God is not in need of them giving up food and drink. And so I think that sort of hits at the duality of, you know, the practical aspects of Ramadan, where people do, 1.7 billion people do fast, but it's also an important time for those 1.7 billion Muslims to also self-reflect within ourselves. You know, in 2013, we mentioned the Ban Ki-moon called for a ceasefire. 2 days ago now, the Arab League and the OIC, the Organization of the Islamic Cooperation, which is the largest umbrella organization of 57 Muslim-majority nations on earth, have called for a ceasefire this year in places like Syria and Iraq and in Nigeria as well. And so, you know, we hope that this this spiritual aspect will also result in some sort of political realities that will make it easier for war-torn people on the ground.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about observing Ramadan in areas of conflict. My guests are Arsalan Iftikhar, founder of themuslimguide.com. He's a regular contributor to our Barbershop Roundtable. Also joining us, journalist Asra Nomani, who has been a regular contributor on a number of our programs and segments. So you know, Asra, you've trained, you've been participating in training over at times over the years, members of the U.S. military on issues of cultural sensitivity. What have you taught them about Ramadan?
Well, I've taught them, you know, definitely don't try to have important conversations with people in the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. Try to wait till the sun has set and, you know, knock on doors or sit down and then try to have meaningful, you know, interviews or conversations. Irritability goes up, you know, all of these aspects that are just clinical of the body. But I also tell them that, you know, it's a moment when you can actually try to reach people in the soft of their heart, because as Arsalan is saying, you know, we all know that there is this higher calling during this month and that there is this effort to try to be the better person, you know, to try to be the better person within yourself. And though there are all of these political initiatives that are being done by some Muslim leaders, you know, I think even they have their own conflicts, and we don't know in some of them, you know, what is sincere and what isn't, and, you know, who's pulling what strings where. And ultimately, the challenge, both on the ordinary people and the leadership, is to try to appeal to the higher self in everyone.
Arsalan, clearly I'm not asking you to speak for these people, but the insurgents who are currently operating in Iraq and Syria, their stated intention is to create kind of an Islamic led a caliphate, I mean, in the entire region, and they're calling upon Muslims to swear allegiance to them. How do you, mm-hmm. how do they, recognizing once again, you don't speak for them, but how do they reconcile that with the call during this period of to lay down arms, to be peaceful, and to abstain from kind of the needs of the world, at least sort of during daylight hours? How do they square something like that?
I don't know, because they're maniacs. And, you know, when you're dealing with people who are, you know, operating outside the fold of logic and reason, you know, if anything, I think, you know, if they continue any sort of armed conflict, especially in Iraq with ISIS, you know, during the month of Ramadan, I think that they're going to lose a lot of credibility from people who might have decided to support them. And so I think that that's something that's very important to keep in mind also, is the fact that, you know, this is not just something where you're dealing with state actors and civilians. In many cases, you're dealing with non-state actors against other fellow non-state actors. And again, here, if you're going to claim to have some sort of Islamic or Muslim platform to your political ideology, it would behoove you to, you know, follow the teachings of Islam, not kill innocent civilians anywhere at any time, and, you know, especially during the month of Ramadan.
And Asra, to that end, both of you, you and Arsalan, are both, you know, activists as well as kind of writers and thinkers. I wanted to ask, is there any opportunity for activism here in support of more peaceful solutions in these areas, or peaceful kind of negotiations or end to conflict in these areas? Is there any evidence of that? Did you ever see that when you were working in Pakistan, that this does offer an opportunity for reflection on the part of people to claim the peaceful, to advance peaceful causes?
Right. I think that, you know, the sad truth is that while there is a lot of activism and calls for peaceful solutions within our community, I don't believe that we have significant leadership that does provide you know, the kind of inspiration for a resolution to the struggle within Islam for the peaceful alternative to prevail. You know, I disagree in that. I think that the folks that are, you know, this Iraq state that's, you know, being called ISIS or whatever, you know, iteration they're going to have, they have a rationale. They have an Islamic ideology that they are behind. And ultimately, it is up to us to try to challenge that Islamic interpretation that they put forward. They think that they're doing the right thing. They do have a rationale to their approach. And we, I'm afraid, don't have enough of a concerted response to it. I think among leaders, among community members, there's folks that are doing a lot of work, including Arsalan. But at the end of the day, you know, we still haven't won that battle.
Arsalan, a final thought from you. We only have about 40 seconds.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, you know, being here at the Aspen Ideas Festival and people learning that it's Ramadan. They feel really bad that all this, you know, great food, you know, we Muslims aren't allowed to eat. What's really interesting for me very quickly is the fact that here, at least in the United States, there's been a lot of interfaith outreach where you have people from the Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu traditions who will fast in solidarity with their Muslim brothers and sisters here. And similarly, you know, Muslims like myself will go to Passover Seders and, you know, do other and share in other religious events also. And I think that's the sort of interfaith humanization that we need to see here in the United States. And hopefully that'll translate itself abroad as well.
That was Arsalan Iftikhar. He's founder of themuslimguide.com. He's an adjunct professor at DePaul University with us, as he mentioned, from the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. Here in Washington, D.C., journalist and author Asra Nomani. Her book is called Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Thank you to you both. Ramadan Mubarak to you both.
Oh, thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
We've been hearing a lot these past few weeks about the extremist Sunni militants who call themselves ISIS and have taken over large parts of Iraq. On Sunday, to mark the beginning of Ramadan, ISIS rebranded itself simply the Islamic State. It announced that this new so-called state was the return of the Caliphate. And the Caliphate was a Muslim kingdom ruled by descendants of the Prophet Muhammad. For more, we've got historian Juan Cole on the line. His latest book out today is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Now, what does it mean in the Muslim world when a group declares itself the new caliphate?
Well, it's a little bit odd because there hasn't been a recognized caliph for it since at least 1924. And I think for most of the Muslim world, you go back to the medieval times since there's been one. So it's anachronistic.
Though, for the group itself, what is it trying to say to the world?
Well, it's a claim on religious authority, but this is a relatively small guerrilla group, a few thousand fighters. It's had some success in making political coalitions in northern Iraq because the Sunnis there feel oppressed and desperate, but it's faintly ridiculous.
You know, we know the Muslim world is divided between Sunni and Shia. Where does this whole concept of a caliphate fit into that?
Well, it is a Sunni political institution of the medieval period. After the Prophet Muhammad died in 632 in Medina, there was a question of how he should be succeeded, who his vicar should be. And just as in Christianity, you know, Protestants have a preference for the teachings of Paul, perhaps, and Roman Catholics tend towards Peter, so in Islam, the Shiites rallied around the Prophet's son-in-law and cousin, Ali, whereas the Sunni tradition believes that he was properly succeeded by a series of notables chosen by consensus from the same tribe as the Prophet, the Quraysh.
So, in a sense, for a Sunni group to declare its lands that it's grabbed a caliphate, that is saying something to the Shias.
Well, it is in a way, in the sense that the Shia reject the Sunni idea of the caliphate, but it's mainly an attempt to rally the Sunnis, and it is also a response to European colonialism because the narrative of these people is that the European colonialists divided up the Muslim world, which had been united, or at least more united, under the Ottoman rulers, some of whom claim to be caliphs. And so by having a center of religious authority that would unite the 1.5 billion Muslims, they could more easily stand up to the West.
Now, you know, a caliphate was something Osama bin Laden was trying to create. It's worth remembering. Obviously, he failed to do that. Is there any reason to think that this small group will succeed where he failed?
Oh, no. As I said, it's in the urbane centers of the Muslim world in Cairo and Jakarta, the vast majority of people would be offended. This is not something that's likely to have much success. And remember, as you say, Mullah Omar of Uruzgan in Afghanistan made similar claims, and I think almost nobody accepts those.
Thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Juan Cole is a professor of history at the University of Michigan, and his latest book is called The New Arabs.
Police officers in Honolulu can't have tattoos showing when they're on the job. That ban went into effect there today. It's similar to policies in other cities, including New York and Los Angeles. But for native Hawaiians, tattoos are often a part of their cultural heritage. They say covering the body art impinges on their religious freedom. Wayne Yoshioka of Hawaii Public Radio filed this report.
A native Hawaiian cultural tattoo is tapped into the skin using a handheld tool. It resembles a miniature rake with needle-sharp tines made of animal tusks dipped in black ink.
Kakao is what we do, but what is remaining is called uhi.
Keone Nunez is a practitioner who taps out tattoo designs just as they were done 1,000 years ago. Uhi, or the artwork, Nunez says, is secondary to the prayers, protocols, and techniques used in the ancient native Hawaiian process.
The symbols identified who you were, identified who your family, had protective meanings for it. And so there is a huge religious connotation to it.
But Honolulu's police chief sees it differently. Louis Kealoha is a native Hawaiian who has a cultural tattoo on his right bicep, but says his dress and grooming policy establishes uniform standards without exceptions.
You cannot say everybody with a cultural tattoo, you know, that's okay because you're expressing your cultural side. You can do that off duty, but you cannot have any visible tattoos. That's going to take away from the professional image of the officer and of the reputation of the police department.
More than 400 Honolulu police officers, 20% of the force, have tattoos on their arms, necks, or faces. Their options are to remove the tattoos, cover them with skin-colored makeup, or wear long-sleeved shirts.
Well, I have several tattoos on my right arm. Almost all of them are visible in a short-sleeve uniform.
Patrol officer Nick Schlepak has tattoos from his wrist to his elbow. Schlepak says covering up tattoos is about more than culture. It can also be risky.
A long-sleeve uniform can be used against an officer. A suspect can grab a hold of it. Sometimes it's hard to get their hands off of it. So you can have safety issues in that respect.
Schlepak also says there are comfort and cost considerations. Long-sleeved, dark blue uniforms are hot in tropical weather and cost up to $40 more than a short-sleeved version. Honolulu Police Union Chair Stan Aquino says the department should not penalize officers with tattoos.
Our main purpose here is to identify where the cost is going to be coming from. You know, we believe it should come from the employer and not from the individual officers themselves.
The department already pays more than $300 annually for uniforms and basic upkeep. But the main issue isn't really about money, comfort, or safety. Tattoo practitioner Nunez says it's the cultural meaning and expression that's important.
When they say that you have to cover up your tattoos or we're not going to hire you because of tattoos, they're looking at it from a very Western perspective. But when you look at it in a more indigenous perspective, they're not understanding the conflicts that might occur with the Freedom of Religion Act and things of that nature.
The Honolulu Police Department motto is integrity, respect, and fairness. Officers with tattoos say they would like the department to respect their freedom to express their culture. For NPR News, I'm Wayne Yoshioka in Honolulu.
Now let's get one more perspective on a deeply polarized debate, a debate set off by this week's Supreme Court ruling in a case brought by the craft store chain Hobby Lobby. The court found that some business owners with religious objections to contraceptives cannot be required to provide them to their employees with their health insurance plans. But does that ruling end there? Our Steve Inskeep digs deeper into what's fueling this debate.
The polarization started with the court opinions. Justice Samuel Alito argued the majority decision was very narrow and carefully tailored. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said the decision opens the door to other challenges to federal rules. To see where we really are, we've reached out to Thomas Berg at the University of St. Thomas School of Law in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Is this ruling likely to limit women's access to contraceptives in some way?
Well, if you look at both the majority opinion and especially Justice Kennedy's concurrence, they both focus on the fact that there is already a mechanism in place whereby employers can object to providing contraception, but women still get the contraception provided through the insurer.
Oh, this was the mechanism that was used for religious nonprofits. They already had an alternative, and so now the suggestion of the court is that other employers could ask the government to provide them the same alternative.
That's right. The suggestion is if it worked for the nonprofit employers, it can also work for the for-profit employers. This is not ultimately a case about whether women should be able to get access to contraception or not. It's about who's going to fund it.
I want to make sure that we follow the competing interests here because the court acknowledges the government has a significant interest in providing health insurance in a uniform way. Of course, the other interest is a religious interest, the religious objection of the employer. Justice Samuel Alito, in deciding whose interest wins, applied a test of sorts, a phrase that he got out of a law from the 1990s. Can you explain that?
Yes. The key phrase the court used is that the government has to show it has a compelling interest in burdening religious freedom, and it has to do so by the least restrictive means. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the statute, allows you to raise a claim. Of course, we know from looking at other lawsuits that people can raise claims, and that doesn't mean that they will succeed. What the court held pretty firmly is that for-profit corporations are not barred from raising claims.
Now, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in her dissent raises or refers to some actual past court cases and wonders if they might apply in similar cases. For example, there was a case of a restaurant owner who did not want to serve black patrons because of a religious objection to desegregation. Is it possible that someone in a case like that could apply Samuel Alito's test, Justice Alito's test, and say, look, you need to find a less restrictive alternative for me to deal with your desegregation law?
Alito, in the majority opinion, expressly cuts off that option and says that there is a compelling interest in preventing racial discrimination. Given the history of our country, a civil war, Jim Crow, that's a direct answer to Justice Ginsburg's hypothetical there.
But wait a minute.
Now,
but wait a minute, because Justice Alito acknowledged that even in the contraception case, the government has a compelling interest. He says, I don't question that, but I still rule against the government because I think they can come up with a less restrictive alternative. Why wouldn't someone say to the government, come up with a less restrictive alternative for me to deal with black people?
Sure, that's a fair question. The court says discrimination cases are categorically different than this kind of funding of employee insurance, where again, the question is who's going to pay for it? And if the insurance can be provided by someone else, then there is indeed no harm to the employees. There are some cases out there about wedding photographers and same-sex weddings. I think those cases will continue to be litigated. The Hobby Lobby decision does clearly say that a for-profit business can raise religious freedom claims. Under the compelling interest standard, which has been applied in previous cases, no one has ever come close to winning on a claim that they could refuse to serve anyone in a restaurant. So, yes, there will be other cases, but I don't think we're going to see the parade of horribles that Justice Ginsburg talked about. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act has been on the books for 20 years, and there are very few claims by business corporations. So if that didn't happen over the last 20 years when those cases could have been brought, I don't think Hobby Lobby is going to make a huge difference.
Thomas Berg of the University of St. Thomas, thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.